You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Home Soil. I'm James from London.
I'm Paula from Kent in England.
And I'm the ugly bag of mostly water, Lou from Nebraska.
Sorry. Well, that was obviously going to come. Why did I not prepare myself for that?
I have no idea.
The synopsis for tonight's show is, when the Enterprise visits an outpost in the process of terraforming a dead planet, they find the science team threatened by a mysterious new form of life. This is the 18th episode of Season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original air date was the 22nd of February, 1988. The show was written by Carl Gaius, Ralph Sanchez, and Robert Sabaroff. And the episode was directed by Corey Allen. Tonight's guest stars include Walter Kirtle as Kurt Mandel, Elizabeth Lindsay as Louisa Kim, and Gerard Prendergast as Bjorn Benson. Mario Roccozzo as Arthur Malincon, Caroline Barry as the female engineer.
And so tonight we have another guest on for Home Soil, and we're reaching all the way out to the United Kingdom. Hey, isn't that where you are, Doctor?
It is.
Okay, Paula.
Hi.
You said you're in Kent, right?
Yeah.
Where is that in relation to London?
Southeast.
It's very near London, really. Southeast. But I'm right on the southeast corner where the Channel Tunnel is. We're going to France.
Hmm.
Okay. So you can see it from my house.
All right. Well, why don't you tell us a little about yourself and what you do and what you like about Trek.
Okay, well, I'm kind of getting on a bit. 21 again and a bit more. And I stay at home with my daughter who's 11. I'm a single mum and I'm actually blind. Probably a lot of your listeners will know that. Oh. And I got into Star Trek when an ex-boyfriend of mine introduced Star Trek to me, and first thing I watched was TNG, and so we spent many weekend kind of like just cuddled up on the sofa watching episodes of TNG. And so that's how I got into it, and then I watched all the other series, and sadly we didn't stay together and we lost touch, but I was forever a Trekkie after that.
Okay, and have you heard our show?
I have.
So, what do we think about this episode? Paula, shall you go first? Let's defer to the lady on the call.
Okay, well, you asked me to come on here because I actually expressed an interest in it. I said I like this episode. And it stands out as one of the good season one episodes. There weren't very many, but there was the odd few. And I don't know. I can't really say why I like it, apart from the fact that it seems to actually have a story to it, even if it might be a kind of predictable story. And I like the fact that they discovered aliens that weren't actually kind of humanoid aliens or even carbon-based aliens. They were sort of something completely different. So I thought that was a little bit unusual.
Okay, yeah, I have to say that you didn't express a huge interest in the show over Twitter, but as soon as there was anything like an interest, I kind of roped you into this.
Say I like it, though.
Yeah, it's kind of like a promise to anyone out there that says, even in a passing reference, that they might enjoy an episode, they might get roped into coming on the show. So consider that a bit of either a promise or a threat, whichever way you want to take it. I thought this episode was okay. I didn't think it was too bad. I mean, we're still in season one kind of territory, but I think something that Lou and I we've noticed and we've certainly brought up over the last couple of weeks is that I think that they've managed to have a number of fairly relatively big ideas over the last few shows, and then they've kind of executed it relatively poorly. And I think again we're in a decent territory of some nice ideas in the way that, you know, they introduced the terraforming, they introduced a new life and things like that. I think there's a little bit of problems with the execution, but I do like its kind of, you know, its initial premise, I suppose. How about you, Lou?
Yeah, I can echo a lot of things that you said, but I can't, because I had a hard time watching this. I'll be honest. I'll be blunt. I had really had a hard time watching this. The whole idea of terraforming of this planet, you know, I guess the question is can it technically be done? I mean, from the only thing she described it as is, we take water, which is really, really, really salty, and then we run it through a filter to remove the salt, and then we, you know, give it a little oxygen, and then we put it back on the planet. Well, obviously, salt water is on this planet for a reason, and once you put the water back, I assume it would just get re-salty again. So, I don't know. It's some about maybe the idea of terraforming a planet, turn it into the Genesis planet is a cute idea. It's just, I don't think this was ever destined to work.
Okay, should we take a moment to go through our forum feedback?
Yes.
Before we get into in-depth analysis.
Sure, Paula, if you don't mind, you can listen to some of the great things that people have said.
I will, it'll be interesting.
Yes, and tonight we left off on Angel 1. And normally we don't record the show for another week, so there's a chance we could miss any other submissions on this particular forum. So we'll try and keep an idea of where we leave off, and in future recordings maybe we can revisit Angel 1 and see if anybody's added anything. But starting off with Captain Proton, I have no idea what it means, but maybe the doctor could figure it for me. It says, candy bar.
I have no clue.
Candy bar. B-A-A-A-R-R. So I'm not sure if Ben was having a stroke that day and he decided to put candy bar on there, but he did get two pluses, so...
Sorry, Lou, I thought you were going to skip that one.
I couldn't resist it.
I think the first serious comment comes from Kieran McDuff, and he says, I have to agree that this episode is pretty grim, which is a shame because it's quite an interesting premise. Someone obviously thought it was a good idea to focus on inequality in society, something that was clearly better in the 1980s than it was in the 1960s, but still had work to do. And as they do in Star Trek, they flipped it. Unfortunately, it didn't really work. As you suggested, all we got was quote-unquote regular women with more effeminate men to try to balance that out. For this to have worked properly, you would have needed a cast list of women like Spice Williams, the female Klingon from Star Trek V, so that they were physically stronger as well as mentally. And by that, I mean the men were conditioned by society to think that they were inferior, not that they actually are. Star Trek is usually good when it takes a problem in today's society and puts its own spin on it. Were we that chauvinistic? You'd have to ask a woman, but I suspect we might have been. Not so much so in the 1980s, but certainly in earlier decades. Either way, I can imagine they exaggerated to make the point. Sadly, they tried and failed. But credit to them for the idea, at least. As for the virus on the ship story, it just seems silly. Beaming Data up was clearly the right thing to do from the very beginning. although given that he was affected by the virus in the Naked Now, maybe this is another case of the writers not understanding Data yet. Or the holodeck, for that matter, given that I'm pretty sure that's exactly where they said it came from. Okay, serious part of this. I have to address the Riker thing. Dressing up as one of the men to suck up to them. Can't they just accept that he's from a different place and he does things differently? If we accept that they can't, and Riker needs to do this, how far was he going to go? He dressed up for them, wore perfume for them, was he willing to go to bed with the elected one? You know, just know she was going to break out the dog collar and strap on. He was going to get dominated. Sadly, this would have made the episode far more interesting than it actually was. I'm giving it a 2 out of 10, and that's only because it was a good idea, poorly written.
He's going to give it a 2 out of 5, though.
Oh, I can't say it out of without putting 10 at the end of it. I apologize.
Poor guy. So I guess it's a 1 out of 10.
It's a 2 out of 5.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it could be 4, 2.5 on a.
Which is higher than what we gave it.
Yeah, it was. let me look at the thing here. I'm pretty sure they were both straight across ones. Yeah, Angel One was one.
Angel One was one. Okay, good.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yes. Let's see. Let's talk about the Riker dressing up thing. Absolutely, there was no reason for Riker to dress up like that. Do you ever run across an alien race that comes to the Enterprise and dresses up in a Starfleet uniform besides Q? So what's the point of dressing up in native attire? We do, however, on the other hand, we see a lot of times on Star Trek where when you go down to a planet that's pre-warp, you will dress as them to blend in as them. But in this case, that's because you don't want them to know you're different. In this case, they already know we're different, so there's no reason for it. The only thing he did it for is he wanted to get into the sack with Mistress Biana. So to accomplish that, he had to show all his glorious chest hair and dress like one of them. Dog collar and the strap on. I don't know about the strap on. Riker's got that already. But the dog collar, I'm not sure about that. Okay, so anyway, how do you say this? Mres. Well, this is Renee, by the way. And
Lou, I'm going to now pull you up. That you clearly have not seen the animated series.
No, I haven't. Not very much.
Yeah. Otherwise, you would know how to pronounce Mres.
Mres. No, I have watched some of them, but I never could get into them, to be honest with you. So, she says, "Hi, guys. Thanks for making what is arguably the worst TNG episode into a fun podcast discussion. Just a couple of thoughts on some things you've talked about. Gender role reversal and matriarchal societies are, of course, very common in sci-fi. The ones I've seen usually either done for comedy or are very extremist and reverse sexist, i.e. set up to show how dashing and smashing the male protagonist is. I thought that this TNG ep might do it better, but nope, sigh. This was just horrible. On beaming, I believe that is indeed the first time we saw direct site-to-site transport from one point to another on a planet. However, intra-ship beaming first came up in the TOS episode The Day of the Dove, where Kirk and company are beamed into engineering to confront Kang and his crew. That's where Spock warns about the possibility materializing inside a bulkhead. Nice thought. When you talked about the shot where the hand comes into the frame to take the glass from Beata, I got out my DVD and freeze-framed it. I couldn't help but think of Morticia and Thing from the Addams Family. So if you're not familiar with that, check out the link with clips to the show, and she provides a link to the Addams Family. They state that non-Starfleet citizens are not bound by the Prime Directive. If so, what good is it? What's to stop, say, freighter crews from interfering where they choose? In TOS episode Bread and Circuses, it is said that Captain Merrick has broken his oath to uphold the Prime Directive. I believe they said he was in the merchant fleet, having failed the academy. the idea of the Odin's crew not being bound by the Prime Directive was just a bad storytelling device, if you ask me. About Data not using contradictions, I believe Dr. Soon programmed him that way in order to make him seem a bit less human, so the colonists would not fear him like they did Lore. Yet the fact that Lal could use them implies that the function was buried somewhere in deep in Data's positronic brain and became activated when he transferred some of his programming to her. And about Dr. Crusher administering the vaccine to the returning away team, I think it was supposed to work as a preventative as well as a cure. As for the rating, I'll go with the same and give Angel 1 a 1 out of 5. A worn-out sci-fi troupe couched in a terrible story. I'd much rather watch The Addams Family. Well, thank you, Thing. Yes, the only thing I'd have to take some little exception on is that non-Starfleet citizens are not bound by the Prime Directive. If so, what good is it? Well, I think, Doctor, maybe you could tell me, but when it comes to, like, freighters, there are freighters that are part of the Federation. Not 100% of the Starfleet is all starships and fun. Some of it is the grunt work, and you have to have a lot of freighters, so they would be bound by the Prime Directive. However, Odin is not. They're not part of the Federation. And I think there's a major difference between the two. What do you think?
Were they not part of the Federation? I thought they were Federation, but they weren't Starfleet.
No. No.
But I've always interpreted, and I have no idea whether or not I'm correct or not, but I've always interpreted that Prime Directive is Federation law rather than Starfleet. So it would apply to people outside Starfleet that were Federation, if that makes sense. And in fact, in the episode that's just coming up, it's, you know, these guys aren't Starfleet. They're in the in the terraforming unit or whatever it was called, and they're certainly bound by the Prime Directive because it's mentioned towards the end of the episode.
Okay, so let's see here, because you do hear them use the word Federation citizens a lot. So I guess you could say the Federation is. But the Federation has multiple planets, right?
Yeah.
But then contained in the Federation is a group called Starfleet. Does that make sense? Is that what we're getting at?
No, I think so. I think so. I've always considered the Federation to be the equivalent of the United States, right? And Starfleet to be the equivalent of the Army.
Good. So because I'm a Federation of the, I'm a member of the United States, I'm not bound by the Prime Directive of the Army. And so the Odin freighter crew, they would be citizens of the Federation, but since they're not part of Starfleet, the Starfleet cannot impose its laws on them.
I think, although that is true, I was always under the impression that the Prime Directive was a Federation thing rather than a Starfleet thing. But I might be incorrect there.
That's interesting, yes, because I hear, like, the Pakleds, they are not bound by Federation laws because they're not Federation citizens.
So, no, of course not.
So that's an interesting point. She raises a very good point. If they are Federation citizens, they should be bound by the Prime Directive of the Federation. Fascinating. So I guess how could a human opt out of both?
Well, I suppose a human can go off and live with, you know, be born to a bunch of humans that ran away from Earth and were raised on another planet somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, taking the analogy of the USA and the U.S. Army, aren't there people that are up in Montana somewhere who pretend to be outside of the federal government?
Right. Yes, there
are. Maybe it's the equivalent of those guys.
Fascinating. Okay. And anyway, well then, maybe somebody smarter than us can figure that out and tell us what they believe the difference is. And she does give a freeze frame of the hand coming in, and it says thank you Thing. So thank you, Renee. That is awfully cute.
Okay, and then to conclude, we've got a posting from Medic 49, which is, good God, this episode is bad. You did a great job getting through it. I don't know even where to begin or end. It seemed like the writers wanted to go out of the way to show how women can be strong and how far we, 80s society, have come since the original series. Mm-hmm. They failed miserably. It's too bad Tasha Yar taking command of the away team mission wasn't the story. It would have been so much better. The only thing I liked about this episode was LaForge taking command, although I agree that there should have been Lieutenant Commander on the ship that would, stroke should, have assumed command. 1 out of 5. I would give it a half if I could, but I must follow your scoring system. Indeed.
Yes, I agree. And what he's mentioning is that the behind the scenes says that there was actual story script where Tasha phasers Commander Riker to prevent him from being killed and then assumes command of the away team. And I would have loved to have seen that. I think that would have made the story a whole lot better. It may have actually come from a 1 to possibly up a 3 for me had that happened. Okay, so thank you guys for your comments on Angel One. Please keep them coming, and don't forget, give your ratings on 1 to 5 with how you feel about it. So, Paula, why don't you start us off with Home Soil, and tell us some of the things that, you know, you have a very unique perspective of all Star Trek, and that you can actually see what's happening. You can only imagine. So this is, this is very fascinating that you would have to imagine what it is that we are seeing, and it's a very interesting idea. So, why don't you tell us about what you imagine is happening and why you like it so much?
Yeah. Okay. Well. First of all, Star Trek is quite easy. Well, Next Generation specifically is quite easy to follow if you're blind because of the. All the captain's logs and things, where they describe, you know, where he almost describes what's just happened, really, you know. So it's not too difficult to follow, but there are some points where I have to imagine. And one of those is obviously the part where Mallinson was going to do the drilling, and all you hear is him screaming, and Deanna said, "Oh, yes, he needs some help." And which was kind of obvious, really, but
right.
And then you hear all the screaming, and so all I can do is imagine what might be happening. But then I suppose, I don't know, you probably couldn't see that bit either, could you? Until they went in the room after they managed to get in, because they, you know, we were locked out, weren't we? So,
right.
In the scene where you know, where the attack occurs, and there's lots of the screaming and so on. I mean, all that is shown on the screen, right, is the locked door. And you hear the screams from beyond the locked door, and you know that's really all you get. So you're not.
So you get the same as me then.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, fundamentally it's a storytelling device, right? I don't think they could have shown. They couldn't really show anything in action in order to keep the suspense and the mystery going into, you know, into later in the episode. So I think it's kind of, you know, it's very deliberate to keep that away from the viewer at that stage.
Mm-hmm. Because after what he went through when Data walks in there. We get to finally see what it is he went through a little bit, a couple shots. But I guess what you missed, though, are there's some nuances in here that I picked up. Like, for instance, is it Louisa Kim? Do you think she's related to PDH? PDL, maybe. But anyway, you could automatically see when she starts to talk about terraforming, William Riker goes, and he gets his boyish grin. And what's funny about it is, as the camera pans from a close-up to a wide shot, you immediately see Deanna Troi's face just smirk, and she turns her head like, "I cannot believe you." Because, you know, she's in front of him, so she has no idea what it is that he's doing with his face at the time she's talking. But you feel it. She obviously feels it. And as soon as she turns around, she, you know, has this very, very subtle, "Oh, you've got to be kidding me," look to her face. It was priceless there.
See, I missed all that.
Yeah.
I think, can I bring up that when they do talk about the terraforming, I think they do a pretty good job of explaining, you know, explaining the concept and the issues at stake. So I'm kind of going to give them credit here, because I think this is really the first time we see terraforming, right? I don't think we saw it in the original series, and then kind of it comes up in Star Trek II as Genesis. But in terms of kind of, you know, everyday plodding terraforming, I think this is the first time. And, you know, they mention how, you know, they have to find a planet of suitable size, suitable gravity, you know, make sure that the night and the day is relatively, you know, balanced and stuff. And I think they do well at introducing some relatively, you know, big concepts to probably an audience who have never really thought about, you know, the concept of terraforming.
But, you know, what gets me is if they go to a planet that absolutely cannot support life, I don't know how even terraforming could change it to automatically be able to support life. If it could, it would.
I think you have to just suspend reality for a while.
Well, yeah, obviously. But, I mean, there's, you know, is there a sunlight? Are there oceans? Except for salty water?
Yeah, I think all that they mentioned was that it had to be the right distance from that star, and oh, the right size of planet for the gravity, didn't they? I think they mentioned that.
Huh. Right. Well, I suppose the basic question, and you know, we don't know this yet, and we don't know when we're going to find out. But I suppose the question is that how many of the planets that are suitable for life to evolve actually evolve life? And, you know, I think that that's, you know, which we're uncertain at the moment, right? We've kind of have one planet that can sustain a life and there happens to be life on it. We don't have any other information. We don't really have a huge amount of strong indication of, you know, the other planets that have been found being in the kind of, you know, in the Goldilocks zone of, you know, potentially having an atmosphere plus relatively warm, you know, climate and access to water and all the rest of the things that are deemed necessary for life to evolve. You know, it might be when we head out to the stars in 200 years, we might find out that there are all these planets perfect for supporting life, but just life doesn't get kicked off for whatever reason.
Huh. I keep thinking of Galaxy Quest. You know, they land on the planet to get the beryllium sphere, and he pops open the hatch, and, you know, is there air? Do you know? So that's another thing. Okay, so they replaced the water. Is there air on this planet? You know what I mean? Another thing, it seemed like the surface of the planet was very, very close to space. So it's almost like there was no ozone, so to speak, around this planet either.
No, I think it doesn't have an atmosphere, or at least a breathable atmosphere yet. But I think that's something, as long as you've got the right... you know, the right gravity, you should be able to introduce an atmosphere. And, you know, when you get onto the second or third stage, when they start talking about bringing in the microorganisms and, you know, getting them being bred and stuff, I suppose that would, you know, sustain the atmosphere and the kind of the oxygen levels. Although I'm somewhat suspicious of this happening in, you know, a couple of decades. I would imagine it would take a lot longer than that.
I think we'd be looking at generations of people transforming this planet one laser beam at a time.
Actually, and here's a question. Do you guys think that there should have been perhaps more than four people terraforming the planet? Because that seemed like an awfully big job for only four people.
I would have thought so, yeah.
Well, I figured it. That was B-shift. And obviously there's some people that are resting, and I often also looked at that terraforming station and thought, that looks really small. So at that rate, with four people on duty at any given time in such a small station, that's got to take hundreds and hundreds of years. You know, to go through this millimeter by millimeter, take out a little bit of salt and put it back. Mm.
And what did you guys think about the kind of the opening teaser when they actually ended up, you know, popping by to the planet? I think it's clear to everyone, right, that the guy that answers the call is as guilty as they come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what I put in my notes here that you know, we're above Valara 3, just beyond the first two, to check on some terraformers who are turning dirt into different dirt. Why? Because we would want to live on this rock someday. And so communications had been erratic, and there had been concerns from the families about the terraformers to make sure they're eating their fruits and veggies and getting the number required number of hours of sleep each day. And, of course, Starfleet, you know, everything's got to be okay because we haven't heard from these people in a while. So, you know, everything's been chugging right along. Here's another thing. Everything's been chugging right along. So we arrive, and within minutes, somebody dies. Is it just our bad luck? Or was he going to die that day anyway?
Well, I don't know if you guys picked up on this, but there's the bit where the director is speaking to the guy that dies just before, you know, just before he goes off. Mm-hmm. And he's all, you know, do you want to go into the drilling room or whatever, you know, the hydraulic drilling room? Mm-hmm. And he kind of seems to suggest that he doesn't, and he's apprehensive about it. And I remember watching this, you know, initially thinking that the director must be in on this because he's...
Yeah, I think I thought that as well because he kind of almost persuades him to go in there, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
like, and it's... And he's kind of like, hurry up, come on, get on with it, you know. Sort of.
Yeah, it's shouldn't you be in the hydraulic chamber, Arthur?
Yeah.
It is very much the case that I took away from this that the guy almost going into the drilling chamber knew something was up and something was going to happen.
Oh, yeah, he was scared. He was very scared.
Yeah.
Transforming makes you feel a little godlike.
I mean, but isn't it really just a grander version of gardening?
I suppose so.
Because that's kind of like what I was thinking about this. And I'm not a gardener. I don't have any inclination or any talent for that. But to me, it came across as a bit of gardening.
Well, I hope you understand I'm going to be somewhat quiet here. As I said, I do have a page of notes. Has 26 points, but a lot of it, some of it was, let's see here. Oh, yeah, number 24 was, at this point, I want to rip my hair out.
It's not that bad at all.
I mean,
what do we have here? We beam down to a planet. It's an interesting sound scientific principle that wouldn't appear on any other show of the time. You know, someone happens to get involved in an accident that ends up killing them. They beam up to the Enterprise. I think a lot of people are very suspicious about what's going on here. You know, it's good stuff. And then, you know, Data and Geordi beam down and, mm-hmm. you know, things progress.
I was going to say, maybe I could summarize this and save us some time. Everything he said. Now, Geordi and Data find a life form. They beam it up. They look at it. They say, what is it? Let's magnify it. Let's magnify again. Oh, we magnified too much. Oh, we didn't. It's getting bigger. It's now starting to tap into the universal translator. Okay, it's time to get out of here. It looks like it's going to blow us up. Oh, it's trying to take over the ship. Hey, I got it. Turn off the lights. Turn the lights off. Hey, they don't like that. See? You were under our control after all. Ugly bags of mostly water need to leave this poor little life form alone, so we beam it down. End of story. Really? That, you know, I understand what you guys are saying, that this kind of...
There was more to it than that.
Well, there was kind of more to it. But this is kind of... Well, honestly, I feel like I could put my headset down and let you guys go, and I'll come back in 20 minutes. For some reason, this episode just bothers me. It's meaningless. Number one, I can't see that you can terraform a dead planet like that. And since we have the Genesis torpedo, we obviously know how to do it. Do it. Why have these people down there drudging through the dirt for however many hundreds of years when you could just fire and boom, the thing's a planet in 15 minutes?
By the way, the problem with Genesis, right, is that you could, you know, it's clear that after Wrath of Khan, they had to uninvent it because it's too powerful.
Right.
So it's not just in terms of, you know, bang, you can have a new planet from an asteroid. But, you know, imagine if you shoot a Genesis torpedo at a, you know, at a Romulan warbird or at a Borg cube, you know, it destroys it. It takes it out immediately.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of too powerful technology that they have a tendency to introduce in the film that works for the immediate threat of the film, but then fundamentally can't exist within the universe without hugely tilting the balance of power. And you kind of can't have that within the television series.
No. So, and that's the problem, though. Okay, after the Manhattan Project, it's here. We've got the atom bomb now. We've got the nuclear bomb. You've got the nuclear bomb. Everybody's got the nuclear bomb. But what I'm saying is you can't just get rid of it. You can't just uninstall it because of the fact that somebody can use it. Or how about Omega? Let's go to Omega. You know, it's good enough to say we don't mess with Omega because this is what's going to happen. But obviously we found in Voyager that others are messing with Omega. So therefore, we can't just stop doing research on it. We have to continue just to save ourselves. So it's the same thing here. Over the last couple hundred years since the Genesis device was introduced, somebody somewhere should have been trying to change it. You know? Because Arthur would not be dead if we could just get the new and improved Genesis, the next generation.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from, but you can't hold that against this particular episode, I don't think.
No, of course not. No, they, you know, I guess they could have been on a beach planet, you know, counting sand, and the Enterprise is going to beam down to find out how the sand counting's going. But, you know, in the process of counting sand, they find this life form that they've been killing with their machines on this beach, and it's going to rise up and destroy them someday if they don't stop. It doesn't matter, really. Terraform was just a method for getting us to the point that there's a life form that we are hurting, even though we've seen this written in the sand, leave us alone, you're hurting us, please stop. I think that's the bulk of the story.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And the fact that life forms don't have to be kind of humanoid. You know, there are different ones. Or in Star Trek, there are.
Lots of different ones.
Yeah.
Now, at what point did the people kind of cotton on to the fact that it was a kind of like an external threat rather than just an internal disagreement among the terraformers?
I'd say when Arthur was killed, they finally realized that there's something there.
No, I think it was after that. I was just trying to think because I've rewatched it several times now. I'm trying to remember when I actually thought that it was an outside threat rather than whatever the guy's name is. I can't think now. But I don't know whether it was when Data went in the room and then the thing was followed tracking him as well. So it could have been then.
Yeah, because we do have the issue where Data goes down and he kind of fundamentally he gets the same thing happen to him that happened to the previous guy, but he's just a little bit more, he's a bit more reflective and manages to get out of there in time. But I still think that I noticed this time, and I'm perhaps more generous to this episode than Lou, you are. But when I was watching, I actually thought they kept the mystery going pretty far into the episode, both in terms of what was happening, and then, you know, when you do see the life forms, it's although looking back and say, well, that's when they found out there was life, I don't think we know for certain that it's intelligent life and it's intelligent life with a will until very, very close to the end of the episode. It's something like, you know, half an hour in out of the 45 minutes before the kind of the mystery of the show turned into kind of like a threat, or at least a ticking time bomb trying to, you know, things to be cleared up before the before the end credits. So I thought it did that pretty well.
Yeah, I think
I'm sure Paul is on my side here.
I am, of course.
I am too. And I think what you're trying to say is that the point all the way up to Arthur's death and that thing attacking Data, the away team was convinced that there was somebody that was causing this to happen. Somebody killed their own crew member, and tried to take Data out from discovering what was going on. They never considered a life, other life form, because Starfleet has declared this planet completely lifeless. And all these little things in the sand, Starfleet still has considered this lifeless. It's got to be something, some bizarre thing happening. I don't think they ever considered. However, at some point, and I think Deanna says this, kind of alludes to this, at some point, these people realize there's a little bit more pattern in the sand. There's a little bit more going on. But if we stop now, we'll never be able to get this done. And since Starfleet has declared this planet lifeless, that's our excuse to continue. And then the Enterprise comes along, and you could tell Mandel just basically didn't want Picard discovering the things in the sand or things that they are noticing, because they want this to continue. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I would say so. I think the only thing that I found that was kind of unconvincing was the fact that the guys all seemed to know what was going on the planet, but Louisa seemed to have no clue. She was like, oh yeah, this, you know, everything's fine. Everybody else seemed to know there was something strange.
Right, because maybe she wasn't that close to the sand.
Maybe. I don't know.
I don't know. Did you see any windows in this station? Let me see.
But the sand was underground.
Right. So how are they seeing all this in the sand, these patterns? And
I thought it was when they were digging. They sent a probe or something down to dig out of the thin layer of water.
Yeah, I wasn't too sure about that either. And then wasn't it Geordi that could see the patterns through his visor, but others couldn't see them? I didn't really understand that very well.
Well, it seemed like they had to turn the lights off, and then they saw the blinking lights.
Yes, I mean, this comes after Data and Geordi go down to investigate, and Data ends up, you know, nearly getting fried by the same program, and Geordi kind of looks down this long hole, and then he sees a light just flashing, and it's nothing more than a single light flashing. But the way that Geordi describes it, I thought it was, you know, obviously Geordi sees other stuff, right? He sees the infrared and, you know, a wider spectrum.
Yeah.
But he sits there and he's saying, oh, it's, you know, he sees so many colors and he sees complex harmonies. And all we actually get on the screen is just a single white light going flash, mm-hmm. flash.
Oh, really? And I thought you might get to see what he saw.
No. He's describing this wonderful thing that, you know, possibly beyond words. And we have to accept it that it's only Geordi that can see this.
What about what was on the computer display with all the... It almost looked like blood vessels flowing.
Oh, you mean when they zoom in?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's... Yeah, I think that's actually... Well, I'm going to say it's relatively accurate, but I think it's just a... I think that anything would look like that ish in some type of, under a very high microscope. I think that looked okay. But they do mention, by the way, but I've got a lot of things later to say about this episode. And certainly I think this episode, it gets touched on later and it almost gets redone later in TNG, but also I think it's a little bit of a redone of previous episodes. But anyway, Geordi and Data are talking about how it's like inorganic and how it can't be alive. And this isn't the first time that people in Star Trek have come across inorganic life. They come up, I mean, it's only a couple of weeks ago that we ran into the silicon, the crystalline entity. Mm-hmm. And that's not organic life, right?
No.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
Makes sense.
Okay. And then what I've got here is that, you know, they go up to the bridge. Sorry, not the bridge. They go up to the Enterprise. They sit down and they are trying to see, you know, what the definitions of life are. And they're speaking to Crusher. And again, I'm going to give it points that it's, you know, it has a relatively decent explanation of what terraforming is and the issues at stake. It then has a relatively decent scientific description of what you need to be alive and and, you know, what you need to observe and whether or not they're applicable to non-organic life and things. But unfortunately, all I could think about, and this is a slight nitpick, and then I'll tell you why this is also, I think this then sheds light on the episode as a whole anyway, is that this isn't the first time they've seen inorganic life, and in particular, the Horta from The Devil in the Dark was inorganic. She was a silicon-based life form. And then it just got me thinking, this episode is pretty much The Devil in the Dark retold, right?
Okay.
In the sense that they, you know, they go to a planet, they do something to the planet that disturbs a life form that they're not aware of. They don't recognize it as being, you know, alive. They don't recognize it as being something that that they're causing, you know, pain and hurt to. And then they kind of, you know, mend their ways by the end and leave with a better recognition of what a correct definition of life is.
I suppose in that way, yeah.
So or was I alone?
The Devil in the Dark was... No, you know, I don't know. I mean, The Devil in the Dark, I guess the creature was a whole lot bigger, seemed more animalistic.
But also they had the they had her eggs.
Yes, well...
And they were after her eggs.
Right. Because, yeah, that's true. They're just eggs. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. And you know something interesting about this episode also is that, as I look on Memory Alpha, a lot of episodes have background information, a little bit about it. There's absolutely nothing on this. I don't know. It just seems like in the lore of Trek, and maybe I'm just a whiny baby, but in the lore of Trek, this one really goes off without much of a kerfuffle. Okay, so the humans are ugly bags of mostly water, huh?
Which apparently we are, according to Data.
But that's a good. I mean, that if you speak.
But to yeah, he's right.
But if you speak to any Star Trek fan, right, they'll know that quote.
It is a famous quote, isn't it? Really. Uh-huh.
And there aren't that many season one episodes you can say have, you know, that you could kind of quote from. I mean, other things, I think one of the most quotable, of course, is Naked Now, with a lot of the, you know, a lot of the stuff going on there, you know, Data being fully functional and all the rest of it. But I think this is, you know, this is certainly a quote that stands out throughout the entire run of TNG, and you've got to give it a little bit of credit.
Okay. Well, I guess we should come back in, what was it, 3 centuries? And maybe we'll be better able to understand them. So what do you think they did with that station? Just picked it up and drove it away? Or do you think they stayed there and worked around it?
No, I think they probably took it away, didn't they? Because it said they put a quarantine on the planet.
Mm-hmm. For 300 years.
Yeah, I don't know how long.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, then. Is there anything more?
There's plenty more.
Well, then talk.
There's plenty more, right?
Keep going.
I like how they beam up the, you know, they beam up the specimen, and in a way, right, they've, you know, Picard and the co, they do something much worse than what the terraformers end up doing, because they identify a life form and they beam him up into a stasis chamber and they sit there prodding him with all the various bits and pieces. And in a way, it's no surprise they get a bit of a comeuppance at the end. Mm. After it grows and gets a bit annoyed about having all of this, all of this infrared light and stuff thrown at it.
Yeah, I don't think I'd like that either.
You thought if they were going to examine it, it'd be kind of almost better to go down to the planet and examine it. I don't know. Perhaps that's a silly suggestion.
In its natural environment, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think this must be the. The smallest thing that's caused the most amount of pain and worry on the ship, I would have thought. I think this is one of the very few times that there's something, you know, so small, so confined to a particular room in a particular deck that seems to be threatening the crew.
It's because it got linked in the computer, though, didn't it?
Yeah, I didn't quite understand how that worked.
No, I didn't.
I think it's that they go away for an ad break. So I think before the ad break, it's something that is sitting there flashing, and I think it splits into two, and they might even split into three, I don't know. But they go away to an ad break, and then they come back from that break, and they start calling it a microbrain that has managed to interface with the computer. And I don't know whether I'm just being extremely slow, but I thought that leap wasn't explained.
Yeah, I wondered how it reproduced itself. Hmm. I don't know. Maybe it was pregnant.
You've been born pregnant.
I don't know, because cells divide, don't they? You know, if like amoebas, I don't know, I'm not very up on my biology, but I'm sure they like a single-celled organisms that just divide, don't they? And don't things like viruses and that do that? But so I understood that, but it was how it linked itself in with a computer that I didn't really get.
No, that's true. That's true. I think the cells are supposed to be like small enough at the moment that they can kind of absorb, you know, various bits and other pieces going around in, you know, either particles in the air or whatnot, and they should be able to bring in enough stuff in order to reproduce. I think that was anyone surprised that they managed to go from a single cell to speaking on the through the universal translator by the end of the episode? I think that was a bit of a pretty steep evolutionary path, I would have thought.
Yeah, okay. Because to me it just looks like a stinking light bulb.
I don't know. I suppose you have to think maybe some time went past that we weren't aware of, maybe.
Because if that's the case, just imagine how many times, every time a light bulb goes out, are we accused of murder?
I don't know about your light bulbs, but my light bulbs, they're not they don't have any intelligence.
That we know of.
That we know of, yeah, I suppose.
You don't know what GE does. Maybe GE gets our light bulbs from... go on.
No, and actually, by the way, this turns into a pretty powerful little, you know, energy life form, right? So you're not able to transport them off the ship. You're not able to put a force field around them. I know that they mentioned, you know, they mentioned very early on that it's inorganic life, by which they just mean that it's not carbon-based life. You know, that's fine, but the ability that the little entity displays seems like it's almost, you know, godlike in its capability. It can block transporters. It can fire off huge amounts of lightning and whatnot. To me, it seems slightly strange that it got to that stage. So I would have thought, inorganic life or not, if it's a single cell, then you've probably got a pretty low chance of surviving for very long outside of your, you know, natural atmosphere or natural environment.
Uh-huh. You're beautiful to us. All life is beautiful to us.
I do this.
Yeah, but they have to say that to stay on the right side of it, really, don't they?
Right. You look like a snowflake. We melt snowflakes.
Actually, I think that was something that this episode was a little bit guilty of, and I think, I mean, not just to pick on this episode, because it happens a lot in Star Trek in general, I think TNG in particular, and first season TNG a lot, which is that you're having, you know, Picard is having a talk to someone, and everyone on the bridge thinks it's like an open panel discussion. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you noticed, but, you know, as Picard was talking to the, effectively making first contact with this life form, people just assumed that it was perfectly fine to start volunteering ideas and suggestions and, you know, you're beautiful to us, honest. And I don't, you know, you wouldn't really want to handle it that way. You'd want a little bit more control, I would have thought.
Mm. Yeah. Well, there was one good thing I liked about this episode in the beginning. is when Picard decides to send an away team. I like the push in on the camera into Picard where people were passing by to the left, to the right, to the left, to the right, and then boom, there's Picard's face.
I don't even think I noticed that. I'm being extremely unobservant.
And I didn't notice, obviously.
But, yeah, so I kind of did like that. I mean, the choreography was pretty good at that moment.
And I don't think any of the acting's bad, right? I think, you know...
Well, it's predictable.
Or am I wrong?
It's predictable. There's a woman on the planet, and there's Riker on the ship. And when the two become together, there's chemistry.
I think that was one of the worst moments of the episode, because it comes straight after Troy speaking to Picard and mentions, you know, that the director was feeling that you know, he knew about the life form, but he was insulted by the suggestion that he had killed any of them. And then she mentions that, you know, what about the others? And she basically says, well, I didn't really get through to the woman. Maybe Riker can go and have a go. And I kind of thought that was a little inappropriate.
If anyone can make her talk. Yes, if anyone can make a woman talk, it's going to be Riker. Okay. What else do I have on here that we haven't discussed?
And why did the alien sound weird through the universal translator? Why does that happen?
I assumed that was because they obviously couldn't like even remotely speak at all. Like if another sort of alien speaks, they do actually talk in some kind of a language where these didn't really have a language. Well, they did, but I suppose it's like lights and patterns and whatever it is. But so I assume the computer just kind of finds some kind of a voice for them. But I don't know why it couldn't be a more convincing, realistic voice. But, you know.
I have to say, I look forward to the day when, you know, I can speak on a, you know, on a starship, and the universal translator will take what I'm saying and any stumbling and mumbling and everything, and turn me into kind of a great Shakespearean orator that can project great, you know, insights through my translated words, and then kind of put into a better sentence.
Yeah, that's such a good point, too, because later on you and I are going to be discussing an episode where Stephen Hawking actually comes on to the show. And you think, today, Google Voice or Google Translate, if you put that in there, put some words in Google Translate, it actually sounds a whole lot more fluent than Stephen Hawking's synthesizer can do today.
Well, I quite often think that because I use a screen reader for my computer and, well, phone and everything, really, and it sounds a whole lot better than his voice. But I don't know whether he's just stuck with that because that's him and he wants to, that's his identity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the one he originally had, so he's stuck with it. It'd be almost like you changing your voice, I suppose, wouldn't it?
It would, yes.
So,
and I was under the impression that he got it upgraded around 10 years ago or so. So the original one that he had was with him for 30 years or something like that.
Oh, right.
And then he got upgraded to, I thought it was an American voice, and, you know, various people wrote into to the English newspapers saying, I'm disgusted that, you know, our great scientist is now speaking with an American accent. I don't know what he's doing now, but when you do see him portrayed, at least in popular culture, whether it's, you know, Star Trek or ended up on The Simpsons, they do keep the iconic kind of you know, robo voice.
Speak and spell.
As part of his identity.
Yeah, the speak and spell.
Yeah, they do. But, you know, he could have a whole lot better. I mean, synthesized voices now can be brilliant, some of them. So.
But it would be weird to have Stephen Hawking, I mean, from my perspective at least, to come across as like a, you know, a great, you know, a well-spoken, you know, I don't know, American, Australian, you know, French gentleman or something like that. That would be slightly out of place now that you've kind of seen him around for so long.
I think that's it. I think, like I said, it's all in his identity now, isn't it? You almost, you know, when you think about him, you almost hear that voice in your head, don't you?
Uh-huh. Yes. Okay, so I've got nothing else. I'm done.
Paula, over to you.
Oh, no. You put me on the spot now. You've just made me wonder why I like this episode now.
Maybe,
I did like it.
Maybe once. You didn't. Until you never liked it. You just wanted to get on the show and pretended.
No.
I'd go with that. I'll accept that. Okay.
Well, maybe. But no, I still claim that it has a fairly interesting story, even if, you know, you couldn't terraform a planet or you may not find a life form like this and it wouldn't take over the computer and whatever and whatever. But it's, dare I suggest that it's science fiction?
that could explain it.
And I,
yeah, it's science fiction. Exactly. But, don't take it serious.
Yeah. And I don't know. I quite liked it. And I just thought it was, it did have a kind of a moral to it in that, you know, respect all life forms, even though there might not be any remotely anything like yours.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I know you mentioned it's science fiction, but also I think it does a good job of introducing a couple of, you know, decent scientific concepts into what rather be a, you know, relative, you know, a drama show, right? So they speak about terraforming and I mentioned this earlier, you know, terraforming doesn't come up every other week when you're watching whatever police detective show, right? So
no.
it's a new concept you introduce, and you mention, you know, how what things you're after. They mention about the water. They mention about even the water being salty, and that kind of feeds in later to the idea of them using it as a circuitry, because, you know, the saltiness would act as the conductor and the way of communicating. All the stuff about the definition of life is in there. It, you know, I watched a lot of Next Generation as a kid growing up, so I probably would have seen this at, you know, 11, 12, kind of that age. Okay. And this is the kind of stuff that kind of gets me into science in a way. It's of course you might not do it like this, and you might not stumble across a creature that, you know, starts out as small as a speck of light and then turns into a huge thing declaring war on you after taking over the computer. But I think there are enough scientific kind of concepts here that I kind of enjoyed it.
Well, that's good. I think you should have enjoyed it.
Yeah, they did explain things quite well, didn't they?
Yeah, I think so. And the show is, you know, it is a mystery, right? For the first, you know, really for the first two-thirds or even three-quarters of the show, it becomes a big mystery about what is what and how things are happening. And it's only right at the end that you can, like, flip the switch and you turn it into this idea that there's, you know, mountain tension. And I like some of the mystery shows.
Okay.
I have to say, Lou, by the way, that with previous experience, you know, we sometimes sound like we're going to be on opposite sides of the divide, and then we come to do the rating, and then, you know, I'll say something like, well, I thought it was great, it deserves a 3, and you'll say, I thought it stank, I think it deserves a 3.
Yeah,
and
I know.
We usually agree on the end rating.
Sometimes.
Even if we slightly differ in, you know, in what points we want to highlight.
Okay. Well, Paula, we're nearing the end of this season. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 more to go.
Eight.
And of those, 5 are already spoken for, so that leaves 3. But is there anything in season 2 that you really, 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 really like?
Season 2?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And think about it, it's one with Pulaski. So.
Yeah, no.
So you have to really think hard.
I watched one the other day that was so bad. It was actually so it was really funny, and I just laughed the whole way through. But it was so bad. You know the one with the Irish people?
Up the Long Ladder.
Up the Long Ladder.
Yeah.
You want that one?
Yeah. Okay.
Paula. Okay, we got you on that one.
But this episode isn't Up the Long Ladder kind of territory. This is a good episode compared to Up the Long Ladder.
Well, it is, but that's what I mean. That Up the Long Ladder was was so bad, I just could do nothing but sit there and laugh.
but again, weirdly with Star Trek, right, the if you look it up, The Long Ladder, the underlying it, there's like this message of how you can't divide a society in two and push people off to extremes, you can't dilute your gene pool and stuff, and you think, okay, that's a quite good, interesting message, but they fit it with like 42 minutes worth of comedy Irishman wandering around and chicken.
I know.
Well,
and by the way, I mean, Paula, I don't know if you would agree with this, but the impression I get from watching a lot of American TV shows, and it's not just Star Trek, and I think famously Heroes in season 4 went terrible on this. You guys have a really weird impression of what the Irish are like.
It's very stereotyped, isn't it? In a not a very Irish kind of a way. It's like, I suppose we do it a little bit here because we had, well, not so much now, but we used to have all those Irish theme pubs and things, didn't we? So they were quite awful, really. But
I don't know. I mean, if I take up The Long Ladder as 42 minutes of silly slapstick comedy at the expense of the Irish, I kind of like it, Riker in, showing the Maggie, is it? Where she can wash her feet.
I think it is.
Where can I wash my feet? Okay, my quarters. I don't know. The Pulaski and Worf, he's hiding a secret, or she's hiding a secret that no one needs to know about, and he wants to honor her in a Klingon tradition. That part I kind of liked. It's just, as Captain Picard said, sometimes you have to bow to the absurd. So in that way, I kind of like that episode.
I think that's why I said it made me laugh. I spent the whole episode sort of giggling all the way through. I was like,
Yes.
It was fun. It was.
And then you get the other race. You got this other race is completely 100%
completely different,
polar opposites, and you've got to make these people, the clones, which one of them I forever thought was Eddie Murphy. I mean, I forever thought it was him, but anyway.
It wasn't.
No, very close, but still, that's I guess part of the story is the complete irony of the two worlds. And so, yeah, that I'm kind of looking forward to. But I've got you in there. And I will say this.
That's all right.
Normally, we wouldn't let a fourth person on. But, hey, you guys are so close to Ireland. If there's somebody in Ireland who really, really has some opinions on the Irish stereotypes that gets just blasted double lock buck in that episode, and you want to be a part of the show, I will bring one more person on. So absolutely we have to do that, just like season 6, I believe it, or no, season 7, maybe we'll get a Native American on and talk about see, I know a few in my family, so that's possible. Anyway, but we've talked longer about this episode than I ever thought we would. So, okay, it's now time to give a final rating on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being absolutely terrible and 5 being absolutely terrific.
Can I go first?
Yes, I would like you to, please.
Okay, because I want to give Paula the moral support in order to come up with a good rating on this. Because I think that this episode is, this isn't one of my favorite episodes. This isn't a great episode. It's a season 1 Next Generation episode that is relatively clunkily executed. I think it has good concepts underpinning it. And I think the last few weeks have shown, I think that TNG has, it's kind of branched off what the original stories were, where it's generally, run into an anomaly here, run into a ship, and so on. And we've moved into more of the sci-fi concepts, like what we saw in When the Bow Breaks, and, Too Short a Season with, the big collide in two big storylines of the, you know, the eternal youth and living with your consequences, and that turned into a big mess. But anyway, I think there are good things introduced here. I think that, you know, the definition of life is a good one. I think that the aliens are interesting. It's certain years, kind of like, you know, it is new life that is like that is going to get touched upon in later seasons, or the definition of life at least, with whether it's defining Data as being alive, or whether it's with the nanites, or whether it's with the exocomps, or all of that stuff. I think a lot of this flows naturally from this episode. I think because it's so early, I think it's clunkily written, and so it doesn't stand out as a great episode that I'm sure it probably could have been had it been tighter and probably put towards the back end of, you know, of the Next Generation run, where they were firing on all cylinders. So overall, I think this comes in at a 3, pretty much middle of the road, in my opinion.
Okay. And Paula? 3.
I was going to say 3. I kind of... You're not allowed to do halves, are you?
Where did this start that we're not allowed to do halves?
You said everyone's that. Allowed to do... You said...
Because I would want to...
There's no such... You said there was no such thing as halves.
No, I didn't say that. I said I thought that people have too much confidence in stating something as a half, when in reality it's very difficult to make that judgment.
Oh, but you see, I would want to give this 7 out of 10, which would make 3.5 out of 5.
Then that'd be 3. It's okay. Well, if Dr. releases the rules,
that's my logic.
Okay, then if
you, can I have that, please?
He can have it. Is that okay, Doc? 3.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
3.5. Okay. Yeah. I guess, you know, the definition of life is, what is it? Cogito ergo sum, I blink, therefore I am. Okay, no. I just came up with that real quick. No, what I really said was, no, I hate this one. I'm sorry. I apologize. And I can't talk about it anymore, so it's getting a 1. And I can't go any lower. It's ugly episode of mostly crap. So, no, I'll go 1.
A 1?
You're giving it a half.
Because Paula asks, I'll go 1.5. 1.5, just for Paula.
Oh, you're so kind.
And now, let's see. We're at 20 episodes right now. No, I'm sorry. Excuse me. We're at 18. Okay, so we're at 18 episodes right now. And so we're a little over the half, obviously over the half mark. And so far, running total, I'm giving season 1 a 2.36. James, you're giving it a 2.61. And our guests have been a 3.83. So they obviously are seeing more on this than we are.
No. There's a selection bias there.
Yeah, there is. Because there's only 3 guests. That's why.
but also, I'm surprised I'm higher than you. Because I thought that despite believing that I'm an apologist, I always thought I came down harsher than you on some of the episodes. But maybe you've just dropped below me this week with the with the 1.5, which ranks it below Code of Honor in your mind.
Right. The only ones you've went under me were for Code of Honor, giving it a 1, and for Hiding Q, you also gave it a 1.
So, yeah.
But the rest of them, yes, you have been a little higher than me, or even. So, yeah. And I've got this thing running as each one goes in, so... And don't forget, hey guys, let's remember one very, very important fact about this episode, okay? That I don't want you to think that it's really all that bad. Part of it is because we're recording this on Friday the 13th, and it is a full moon out there. So if you guys are willing to go with that, I'll go with it can't be the episode. It's the whole Friday the 13th on a full moon. You good with that?
Is that why you nearly convinced me I didn't like it?
Yeah, just about. Werewolves out. Anyway. So, Paula, thank you for coming on. And if there's any others in Season 2 that you want to talk about as well, you know, just send us an email or get with James, whatever you want to do. So far,
Okay. Only
you have asked to be on Season 2. I've got Brian Detamore for The Emissary. but I haven't heard anything more from him. I generally try to keep the Klingon episodes for the Klingon, but other than that, you know, we'll let anybody Kapla. On. Kapla.
Well, yeah.
Yes, he was our Klingon. So
next time on Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Bring that ship back at once.
I've lost power.
The captain struggles to save a runaway shuttlecraft.
May you all do your best.
And Wesley meets the ultimate Starfleet test.
Look at us now! Come on!
Now, both face the toughest challenge of their lives.
Pull up hard!
6 seconds to impact.
I'm gonna crash.
On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Let me also thank Paula for joining us this week. And please join us next week as we review Season 1, Episode 19, and that's going to be Coming of Age. So I'm James from London.
Paula from Kent in the UK.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska, ready to take on my deepest fears too.
So thank you for listening, everybody.
Thanks for having me.
And good night.